Good evening, everybody. This is Doug Scioca coming to you live from the headquarters of Kavar Capital. And I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight. It has been a very volatile and very trying 4 weeks in the financial markets, which are an offshoot, of course, of the global economy, which, as we know, has been under attack by the coronavirus. Before going forward with our call, we, as all people around the world, want to express sympathy to those who have perished and encouragement to those who've been afflicted with the COVID-19 coronavirus. This is the first time we've endeavored on a widespread communication of this type, so we are hopeful that it will be effective. Everyone who is dialed in right now is on mute status. And once we conclude some prepared remarks and address some questions that were sent to us ahead of time, we're going to open the lines for any questions you may have. You can indicate an interest of coming off of mute by pressing *9. Then in the order that any questions come in, we'll identify you by reading the phone number from which you dialed in. So again, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We actually have a fantastic turnout. As I said, I'm Doug Scioca, and with me at our office is Tom Bowling. John Nagel is dialed in from home, and the three of us will be presenting tonight. I will say there's very little that brings a small team like ours together, like anxiety in the capital markets and concern across our client base. I'm hopeful that our team approach embodies the comprehensive coverage that we try to espouse in our service model. I want to be sure that all clients, old and new, well, not old, mature and new, know that we are literally available 24/7. There is no one at Kavar Capital that is in sales. All of us are in service. Please know that service extends beyond any conventional bounds of business hours. Also, for your comfort and information, we are fully equipped to operate as a company remotely, and some of us have been doing so actually intermittently this week and last. So let's jump into the heart of the meeting content. The coronavirus has been the primary catalyst for some incredible and persistent capital market volatility in the last 4 weeks. And when I say volatility, I'm really referring to intraday price fluctuation of the major stock indices. Here's a great example. In just the last 10 trading days, including today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has experienced the following moves: plus 5%, minus 13%, plus 9%, minus 10%, minus 6%, plus 5%, minus 8%, minus 1%, minus 4%, plus 5%. Perhaps even more amazing is in 7 of those 10 days, the Dow has closed higher or lower by more than 1,000 points. In addition, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has now experienced 2 consecutive up trading days since February 5th and 6th. And while the stock market attracts most of the volatility attention of the average investor, the volatility has not been confined to just that one area. We have also seen really significant moves in credit markets. The most well-known of all credit markets is the U.S. bond market. The U.S. bond market has historically been the beneficiary of what is known as a flight to quality. When all else seems amiss, the obligations of the U.S. Treasury offer security and comfort. When that security and comfort is sought out, its price goes up and its yield goes down. Using the 10-year bond as a proxy, just to give you an idea of its allure, the yield now stands at 1.08%. Lend your money to the federal government, you'll receive 1.08% fixed for 10 years. Amazingly, this is higher than it was a week ago by double. Yeah, the yield on the 10-year bond fell below 0.5% last week as panic in the market intensified, also contributed to by some actions taken by the Federal Reserve Bank, literally intended to offer large bucks of liquidity to keep markets operating efficiently, albeit erratically. Lastly, we have experienced some extreme pressure in commodity markets, principally the energy markets. 1 week ago Saturday, the Saudis began a price war with the Russians as payback for noncompliance and production quotas and turned on the taps to drown the market with oil and in the process compress its price. Since February 21st, goes back a little further than the OPEC standoff, the price of a barrel of oil has been cut. This may offer some cost savings for consumers of energy, but that benefit is more than offset by the adverse impact it is having on domestic companies engaged in the production, exploration, and transportation of oil and natural gas. The timing of this oil shock on top of the coronavirus consternation could not have come at a worse time for investors. Not only have energy stock prices been hit hard, but the energy bond market has suffered as well. Given the capital intensity of the energy business, many oil companies borrow from investors to fund their operations, and the double whammy of a volume and margin cut has left bondholders and stockholders with a very bad taste in their mouth. It is safe to say that the outbreak of COVID-19 has threatened to grind the global economy to a complete halt. Its spread, mortality rate, and evasive treatment options has, in our opinion, created more uncertainty and inactivity and fear since 9/11. And if there is one thing the market hates more than anything else, it is uncertainty. I will not go over all the stats since the market and economy began reacting to the COVID-19 threat, since we included detailed figures in the document which accompanied this invitation. But to summarize, before today, the U.S. stock market dropped almost exactly 30% in 29 days, an unprecedented speed for such a decline. I'm going to turn this over now to John Nagel, as he has spent some time comparing the activity of the markets with prior periods of extreme volatility, be they man-made, like the global financial crisis of 2008-09, or exogenous, such as the period we are currently undergoing. While there is no well-worn roadmap out of an economic crisis, there are guideposts that can prove reliable in ascertaining important points on the path to recovery. Once we hear from John, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the government intervention being considered to assist in addressing the slowing global economy. John?
Thanks, Doug. So I put together the document that accompanied the reminder email that contains some data and information that attempts to compare the current market to historical markets of similar volatility and drawdown. We kind of hit the low point yesterday. It was the third worst single day in market history. S&P 500 dropped 12%. And that culminated in the current drop of 29.5%, which puts it into what we consider a bear market. If we go back and look at former bear markets in history, this is a fairly common occurrence. There have been 11 official bear markets. There are different ways to calculate them, and sometimes you can even have bull and bear markets within larger secular bull and bear markets. But for the purpose of this exercise, we just defined it as a 20% drop from all-time high closing prices. And we said it's not over until they recover that all-time high price and move past it. So for this one, we're down 29.5%. And that happened in only 23 days, which is remarkable historically. It's never happened that fast. The closest example, which is one of the periods that we'll look at, is October 1987. Some of you will remember a one-day drop of over 20% in the market after there was some weakness the week before. So that's from a speed and ferocity perspective. That's the closest example. But we want to look at, so the most recent example would be the global financial crisis. Like Doug said, that was man-made. And how it compares to this one is just the unrelenting market volatility. And I'm just going to point out a few takeaways from these. And for this one, in 2008, we saw the tables included in the document, but we saw two of the worst 10 days in history. We also saw three of the 10 best days. So, and in the current environment, we've already seen two of the 10 worst days, yesterday and then Thursday of last week. And the takeaway from an investor perspective is staying invested, because you don't get the best days. You don't get to miss the worst days and get the best days. You have to stay invested through these turbulent times in order to capture all days, and ultimately it helps you out. There's a great chart in the document that you may have seen before that shows you the returns if you miss those, if you miss the 10 best days, which is only possible by experiencing the worst days. That's the only way to maximize your return. Okay. So now jumping back, an event that we think is very similar to today's because of the aspect of coronavirus being an exogenous, non-financial, non-market event is 9/11. And we think that this is going to allow us the best comparison to the effects that it may have on the economy. As you know, the world is completely slowing down. Businesses are closing, and we don't know how long it'll last, that people will stop going to restaurants, stop spending money, stop going on trips, stop taking flights. During 9/11, the market closed from when it happened on Tuesday, it closed the remainder of the week. When it reopened, it fell about 12% the following week. And that was, and if you remember that time, it was just a complete fear of unknown what was going to happen with the market, with the financial system, with consumers. Nobody wants to leave their house. So that's why we think that compares the best to kind of the societal impact of this event. The market, again, hates uncertainty, like Doug said, and there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty about how widespread this pandemic will get and how it will affect consumers. And obviously that trickles down through the economy and then into corporate profitability, which is why there's such uncertainty around the investor's ability to accept risk in the stock market. The last event is one that I touched on earlier. It's the 1987 crash, and that is just the speed of this sell-off. We went from all-time highs to a 30% drop in less than a month's time. That really has only happened one other time, and that was 1987. And the interesting thing about 1987 is that it's still up to debate what actually caused that sell-off. It was just investors kind of rushing to the exit, and there's a good analogy of yelling fire in a crowded theater where everyone just storms to the door and you don't want to be the last one out. And that's what it kind of feels like. As this sell-off has accelerated, it's just that it's a vicious cycle of not wanting to be the last person to sell before the bottom. And we feel like, you know, that market behavior is really prevalent today. So now I'll turn it back to Doug and Tom. I believe we'll start the question portion.
Thanks, Johnny. We're going to just interject real quickly because it's really been fast and furious as it's related to some legislative initiatives that are being designed to assist in stabilizing an economy that is faltering because of so much inactivity related to the fear of it contracting and transmitting the coronavirus. Last Friday, when John had mentioned we saw one of the market's best days of all time, it was on the heels of a press conference that we were actually seeing some bipartisan cooperation to pass legislation to provide assistance to laid off hourly workers, to companies that had to close, prospectively to cruise lines and airlines and other members of the hospitality industry to assist them in navigating this difficult time. Those kinds of initiatives are underwritten by the federal government and at this point in time are seemingly mandatory to offer a lifeline to certain industries and employees in the absence of consistent revenue and compensation. The final details of the bill, which we thought had passed on Friday night, but needed to go back for some technical modifications on Saturday, but then actually passed the House yesterday, are supposedly being finalized in the Senate either tonight or tomorrow, which will hopefully land the bill on President Trump's desk for him to quickly sign into legislation, is a great first step. There's still not 100% certainty of its contents. There is a component which is affectionately known as helicopter money, where everyone on this call may be receiving a check. Everyone who receives Social Security could see an adjustment. There are a lot of details that have yet to be ironed out, but suffice to say, and very encouragingly so, I feel like the powers that be are aligning their interests for the betterment of our country in this capacity. So that's very refreshing. In addition to a lot of the legislative initiatives at the fiscal side, which is our government leaders and elected officials, there have been daily evolutions. I guess that's the wrong way to say it. I mean, things have evolved daily on the monetary policy side. I mentioned about the Fed cutting interest rates to stimulate the economy. We mentioned about the Fed slathering the markets in liquidity, which is just a crude way of saying if people want to get in and out of positions, whether that be for borrowing, lending, investing, or spending, they want banks to have the capacity to make that happen. Right? If you remember in the 2008-9 financial crisis, the credit markets seized. That was the quote that we heard all the time. Banks were closing down loan extensions to counterparties because they were not confident that whomever they lent money to today would be around to pay them back tomorrow. This in no way resembles that level of concern or insecurity in the financial system. Thankfully, because of what we underwent in the great financial crisis, banks went into this coronavirus crisis very well capitalized with ample backstop liquidity to be sure they could continue to express money into the economy. The Fed is making that even easier on a daily basis, and we do applaud their efforts. If we can get the parallel tracks of fiscal and monetary policy simultaneously assisting the economy through this challenging time, that is going to be critical to us surviving and thriving as we bridge this gap. I had a lot of people say to me a week and a half ago when the Fed cut rates, does the Fed realize that cutting rates doesn't cure the coronavirus? Yes, the Fed realizes that. So does Congress. We're not right now, thankfully, have what seems to be a very functional coronavirus task force. And I don't know if all of you are as in love with Anthony Fauci as I am, and it's not just because he's Italian, but he lends a level of credibility to this effort that I think was severely lacking, and I think provides great comfort that there is a very strong group in charge of leading our effort. I'll stop there. And Tom and I are going to address a couple questions that have come in, and we'll just take maybe four or five of those, and then we'll open up the opportunity for you all who are on the line to ask questions. If there are no other questions, we do have some others that people had sent in. So, Tom?
Yeah, thanks, Doug, and thanks, everyone, again, for dialing in. This is the first time we've done something like this. We hope it's a medium we can use going forward. We've had lots of conversations with lots of you over the last several weeks and received several questions from you in advance of the call, but we've also put down a few that we've had consistently over the last several days. So like Doug said, we'll address a few of them and then try to open it up for more interactive activity. You know, one of the consistent questions we got, and it was also submitted prior to the call, is, you know, should I raise some cash and wait to buy into the market at a lower point? And, you know, the overriding theme that has come from this is just the psychology of going through a market event like this and wanting to take control of a situation that's rather uncontrollable at this point? The answer really is more nuanced than you think. Normally, obviously, as John Nagel pointed out in his remarks about missing the best 10 days in the market and trying to market time, historically has not provided a lot of reassurance and has been very fleeting. So certainly we would not recommend trying to time the market in the short term. None of us know at this point when the market will reach a bottom. Having said that, each client is unique in terms of their time horizon and financial goals. So we'll get to this in a second as it relates to those that have near-term funding needs. But if they're, what we've been trying to do with all clients and do consistently over time is identify what capital needs they have over a short, intermediate, long-term basis and make sure we have funding sources that can meet those obligations. So to the extent that there's a period of time where we catch a little bit of a rally and can free up some capital for someone that has a known obligation in the future, that's an opportunity. But for the most part, that's what asset allocation is about. And we would not recommend trying to time the market and wait to buy a lower point. You have to be right about selling and right about buying.
Thanks, Tom. One question we had received was, should I sell all my bonds and go to 100% stocks? While the answer dovetails with Tom's comments about an allocation that's proper for your time horizon, need for income, and intestinal fortitude, we also look at bonds, and I'm quoting a gentleman on CNBC because I love the way he said it, bonds are your ballast, right? Bonds are there to be a preservation of principal. That principal preservation is well needed often when you least realize it, because when exogenous shocks impact the market and cause tremors in your portfolio, having a ballast in the form of bonds in appropriate percentage for your personal goals can be very beneficial. So in general, should I sell my bonds and go 100% stocks? I would suggest not doing so. I would suggest that under the presumption that the bonds were there for an appropriate reason when the allocation was established.
Yeah, and I think it's just to piggyback on that question, you know, we talk a lot about kind of the compartmentalization of asset allocation, right? So if we, most of us think of our portfolio as one large bucket, but within that bucket, there are asset classes that perform differently in different periods. So, for example, right now, the bond portfolio or the bond portion of our buckets has held up rather well, in many cases appreciated. That can be used as a short-term funding vehicle for those that are in need of cash flow and have expense obligations in the near term, and allow for the equity portion of the portfolio to really, have a 3 to 5 year time horizon before we need to tap into those assets. Another question that has come up pretty consistently is, what actions should I be thinking about during this period, and how do I capitalize on opportunities in this marketplace? So, on the first point, there's a lot of actions. We put out a piece last Thursday on the financial planning side, just talking through some principles of tax loss harvesting. This idea that we can improve the tax efficiency of our portfolio during times like this while we wait for the market to recover by selling investments that are showing a short-term loss, buying very similar investments at the simultaneous time so as not to disrupt our asset allocation. That's one. I think it's always worth revisiting your cash flow plans in the retirement plans to look at, in the context of this market downturn, how has this changed, if any, my retirement plan? That can often be the that provide the context that allows you to get through this environment when you say, you know what, this has been disruptive, but as it relates to my goals and this compartmentalization imagery, I've got resources that can propel me for the next 3 to 5 years while I get through this this market downturn.
Okay, one more question. I guess we'll do two more questions. This is a two-part question. Given a wide range of client risk profiles, how does your team manage investment expectations in these very volatile markets? And then what is the best way to interact with Kavar during this period? So initially, when clients become clients of Kavar Capital, we spend a lot of time up front in ensuring that we are building an asset allocation consistent with your long-term objectives. Thankfully, as most advisors in our capacity, we've made a large investment in technology and systems in order to be sure that in spite of having, and understand, Kavar Capital is a boutique firm. We do not have thousands of clients. We feel fortunate to work with a select group of folks that have put their trust in us. But as I mentioned in my opening remarks, we're not salespeople. So we don't have anyone out there beating the bushes, constantly trying to find new relationships. Our investment is in our clients. And part of that investment is having systems that can allow us to be certain that we're staying consistent in understanding where the sensitivities of each client lie. Revisiting those with regularity throughout the year is certainly important because as life happens, we want to make sure that we're contemporary and up to date with how anything that is happening in your life impacts your financial well-being. As far as the best way to interact with Kavar Capital, however it is best for you. I'm not sure all who is on the line, but whether it was calls last night at 9 o'clock, calls this morning at 6:30, conference calls over the weekends, we are available 24/7, and that is not an exaggeration. When we go through something like this, our availability is paramount to your comfort, and that will never be challenged. So, Tom, do you
just to add real quick, just on the operational side, Doug mentioned the technology and so forth. We've got great systems in place that allow us to not only trade with efficiency across many accounts, but do it in a customized format. Because every client of Kavar Capital, while there's consistency in some of the holdings they have, there is a customized approach to their portfolio. So we have been very nimble throughout the last few weeks, and will continue to do so, and have had no disruption at all in our activity.
You want to take this one about GDP and unemployment?
Yeah, you know, and I'll have John Nagel jump in too on. So, John, one of the questions is, what is the expected impact to GDP based on kind of the early information we're receiving, and also as a secondary to that, unemployment? And I'll let you kick it off, and then Doug and I will chime in.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah. So, obviously, that's a huge unknown, but there are some estimates coming in. And for us, we typically rely on a collection of banks and research shops and different economic entities for our forecasts, and we try to pull them all together. And we don't have a Kavar Capital consensus GDP estimate, but it seems to be consensus that between 5 and 10% contraction for this for the second quarter is in line for the U.S. GDP. So what does that mean? It means so GDP is about $21 trillion for the U.S. full year. So if you take that, if you take 5% out of that, that's nearly $300 billion. In GDP coming off the table. Obviously that's a lot, that's a big chunk. One of the positives you can draw from that though is that $20 trillion, so all of US GDP, has come out of global equity markets this year. So there is a little bit of a disconnect between how big of an impact it'll be from the economy versus the equity markets. Most people are forecasting a deep, quick pullback and contraction in GDP activity, and then a return to normal. That's what happened in China. So their numbers are coming in, and they shaved about 8% off their GDP for the quarter where they shut down. And now they're going back to work, and they're seeing the rebound in productivity. So we'll see how quickly they snap back, and that could be a good corollary to how quickly the U.S. economy will snap back.
Yeah, hey, John, that's great insight. Let's just drive home that point real quick. So a 5% contraction in GDP amounts to about $250 to $300 billion a quarter, right? And in terms of lost economic activity, but the financial impact on the markets so far this year is equal to about $20 trillion. So it seems like there's a big disconnect in terms of lost economic activity and lost market value.
Yeah. And so I was looking at it. Also, it's primarily going to be a consumer story. Everybody's going to stay home and not spend their money. So I looked at kind of what makes up the gross personal consumption expenditures that goes into the GDP formula. And if you go to the services section and you find the one that includes restaurants and leisure and bars and hotels and travel, makes up about 15% of spending, which makes up about 2/3 of GDP. So if you take all that out, if you just say for the whole quarter nobody's going to spend a dollar, that would equate to a 9% contraction in GDP. So that's like worst case scenario. Obviously people are going to spend something, whether and in some cases they could be going to the grocery store instead of restaurants. So it's unclear, but 5 to 10%, 10% worst case scenario, 5% kind of the consensus seems reasonable. On the employment side, that's a little more unclear, but they are seeing jobless claims trickle in through various states, and obviously there's going to be a huge spike in those whenever the national data comes out. But we also look at those industries, those restaurants, bars, hotels, services that will be really impacted, where people are going to be laid off, and maybe some whole small businesses have to shut their doors and close. That's about 12.5% of the entire workforce. So that's the worst case scenario, is if everybody there loses their job and goes unemployment, then that's pushing it to over double digits, which is over the financial crisis. But I think that's worst case scenario. It's probably more like you do get a pop up to maybe high single digits unemployment, but hopefully there's a big snapback and people go back to work as soon as all this social distancing is over with.
Thanks, John. So that kind of concludes our prepared remarks. We really like to open it up to a few questions. And just as a reminder, in order to ask a question, please push *9 on your phone. That'll put you in a queue. We are going to protect everyone's anonymity and just read off your phone number when you see that you're in the queue, and we'll let you know when it's time to go. We'll give it a minute just to queue up a few questions. Okay, it looks like we're going to go to our first question. Telephone number 239-405-8669. Go ahead when you're ready.
Hey, guys. Well, hi, this is Bob Stewart. And first, you know what a big fan I am of the Carver family, and especially you three guys. Just a couple of questions. You know, one, in addition to the capital gains and the growth that we have, a lot of us depend a lot on the yields of the stock, the portfolios we have. Is there any real concern about industries that John just referred to, like the restaurant industry with a McDonald's or other chains that have a high yield, the retail industry like a Procter & Gamble or others, that as this business is getting pretty hard, hit pretty hard, you know, are those yields at risk? And the other question I would have is just that, is there any industry that you feel has been unfairly hit by this just swing that's been going on because of this crisis?
Hey, thanks, Bob. It's Doug, and I'll take the first part, and then Johnny, I'll let you answer on the industry piece. And Bob, we absolutely respect that. You know, a big part of our investments philosophy emphasizes total return, and the total return is both appreciation and income. And we love stocks that pay nice dividends. It is an evidence of cash flow generating capability. It is not something that can be faked. It is a nice reward to shareholders for sticking with you through good and bad times. There is no question that some of the industries that John mentioned could have cash flow issues that could suspend or cut their dividends. Thankfully, from our perspective as a company, we don't have a lot of individual positions in some of the most hard-hit industries, with the exception of the energy industry, where we do have some. The hospitality industry is so transient that there oftentimes is more of a retained earnings and capital preservation of earnings than there is a distribution mechanism. Some of the more tried and true industries like consumer staples, healthcare, industrials, they typically have what are called dividend payout ratios that are very shareholder friendly in that they don't tend to extend beyond their 100-some% certainty. When I say 100-some%, typically a lot of companies will pay out dividends, but not with the full amount of the cash flow they're generating. So we don't feel like there's grave concern right now, particularly with blue chip, high quality companies in some of these industries. But should this persist for a while, should there be any hiccup in reception of government benefits that are going to come down, particularly to the most adversely impacted industries, then we'd have to revisit that. But for some of the companies like you mentioned, I think they're starting to see even more shareholder affection just because they offer very tried, true, and frankly boring business models that right now are very fashionable.
Yeah, I'd add one point to that, Bob. You know, the three sectors that are most prominent in our portfolios are healthcare, consumer staples, and technology. And pretty universally, those three sectors seem like they'll be the worst or hit the worst of this. You know, certainly healthcare in a lot of ways is benefiting. Consumer staples, to a large degree, is benefiting as consumers refocus their expenditures. So there's going to be pockets in companies that might have to reduce or cut their dividend, but we're hopeful as we look through our portfolios, it'll be minimal impact to us.
And then, John, do you want to talk about the industries that have suffered the most?
Sure, yeah. I mean, energy is a big one, obviously, and it's an industry that was not fully recovered from 15-16, which was another just flush out of oil prices and companies that are, like Doug was saying earlier, how their capital structure works is they have to have access to markets at all times. They borrow a lot, they've got a ton of leverage, and that leaves them a little margin for error. So the energy is just a very tough space right now. It's got a lot of secular headwinds. There's a lot of legacy oil and gas companies in there, and there's no doubt that fossil fuels are being used less and less. And then you layer on that all the financial troubles and now the low commodity prices. That one's hard to see a real quick rebound from those companies. Although, it's not like the industry will completely go away, but it's hard to really see that being a leader going forward. Financials could be one that you would say is being unfairly tossed out. I mean, everything is being sold right now. There's nothing really that's winning, but financials, to see the drawdowns and the valuations now on some of these banks is pretty crazy. So now it's at the financials industry for the S&P 500 is at an 8.5 times forward PE ratio. And I talked a little bit about PE ratios in the paper. It's just the price earning ratios. Everyone should be somewhat familiar with that. But so financials is 2/3 of its historical average valuation right now. And we know interest rates compresses their margins somewhat, but that was already a cheap sector. It got much, much cheaper. So we could look for some opportunities there. And then, like Tom was saying, even though staples, healthcare, and technology have sold off, there are obviously a couple of those companies are winners in the current scenarios. If you just look at the lines at Costco or the things that people are stocking up on, those numbers, when they come through next quarter, are going to be really good. And then there's industries that are pretty insulated from this and are pretty durable, that like technology, where we're actually using more technology because of this. As a company, as people are working from home more, trying to be connected more. So I would highlight those three that have been good performers, but you know, you're still looking at technology being down 20%, which is good relative to the market, but you're still finding those companies that are so dominant now at discounted valuations from where they were.
Great. Thanks, John. Now we're going to go to a question from 816-582-8700. Go ahead when you're ready. Again, a question from 816-582-8700.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi. When you do your investment planning, do you take into account the length of time for recovery? And when I say recovery, I guess what I mean, for instance, Governor Cuomo today said that he expects the virus to peak in 45 days. So we're going to keep doubling and doubling and doubling and doubling for another 45 days before it levels off. So if that were the case, you know, we don't know, but if that were the case, would that change any of your investment strategy?
You know, it's a good question. I think we're certainly in uncharted territory as it relates to this virus. But what I would say is the market by nature is what we call a discounting mechanism. So what we fully anticipate is the market will bottom potentially before we see a peak in cases, because it's going to try to, the market's trying to anticipate what the financial impact of all this is and price that risk prior to it happening. Now, the time frame, the market's typically looking at 2 to 3 years out in pricing securities. Now we're trying to price them on a daily basis, trying to understand what the next 30 days is. So I think to your point, it's been difficult to understand what the earnings and economic impact has been. It's a very fluid situation, but you know, I don't know that it would change our strategy to find out that this this epidemic is going to be around for a couple of weeks longer. I do think that once we see at least the rate of new cases begin to slow down, that could be a good indication that we're getting on top of the outbreak. I don't know if Doug, you wanted to jump in.
No, I mean, I think it really underscored the point to see the reduction in the collective market value decline of that 29% drop equaling $20 trillion, even though we're stress testing an economy that could see a reduction of $300 billion. And the market does try to run ahead and pull forward the worst case scenario. And it's a way that it deals with fear and dealing with uncertainty. And I think, you know, that is, as John mentioned, characteristic of prior period pullbacks. And I think it's something that when we get the resolution, right, there's this preoccupation right now to describe the shape of the recovery. Is it going to be a V? Maybe a U? Well, how long about in the U? Maybe a W. And at the end of the day, that isn't as important to know that the bulk of the first leg down is likely close to having exhausted itself. That does not mean we can't go lower. You know, there's a lot of questions we get about algorithmic trading programs and machines are in charge and individuals are not really making an impact on what's taking place. A lot of that is true. And one of the reasons we see the speed in this drop is because it is driven by a lot of program trades. We saw a huge amount of speed in the drop in the fourth quarter of 2018, but we also saw was a tremendous amount of speed in the recovery. So we're confident that when the market has factored in the worst case, and the question that you asked may say, well, is the worst case really factored in 45 days? Does it need to get a little worse than that? Should that be the case, then we should expect to see some ongoing volatility. I think that would probably be responsible to presume. But at this point in time, we're more concerned about being sure that our allocation is consistent, to be opportunistic, to manage for the present and invest for the future, so that we achieve a balance and a level of comfort with how our assets are allocated.
Thank you. Yeah, great question. Thank you for that. We're now going to go to phone number 570-460-9629. Go ahead.
Doug, you mentioned before the legislative activity that happened over the weekend and continued through the first part of this week in the form of assistance, federal assistance, that would help people by way of an actual check. And you had mentioned that could be a big factor. I followed this somewhat through till Saturday night, where what I understood was that those bills that were being passed had a cap on them and excluded companies over 500 people. Is that true or false? Or can you just in a capsulized form give us an understanding of what you think is on the way in help? That's my first question.
Yeah, so great question. And I don't know the details yet. There were, what they said at the press conference on Saturday was there are some technical issues that need to be addressed to modify some of the actual economic statistics. I'm not certain that was one. That had been the threshold by which they were defining a small company. So that was the number that I also had heard was 500. There is now a revision in the Senate that supposedly that is using the base that was passed in the House and getting a little bit more creative in the Senate to use that format and enhance based upon an understanding that it needs to be more widespread. Now, that widespreadness, I can't say for sure if that incorporates the threshold for which companies are eligible. If it just in the last couple days, it's gone from $1,000 per person to $2,000 per person. Earlier today, we heard $3,000 per person that's just going to be mailed out. So I'm happy to send along the information that we have as we receive it. But it's a pretty fluid situation for sure.
Yeah, I think that there's two components of it. There's some relief coming to specifically to businesses, both from a credit perspective, tax relief, and so on. And then there's another round of relief coming to individuals relative to these checks that will be distributed within a couple of weeks, it sounds like. So very, very fluid, but it's clear that there's going to be a pretty significant response.
Okay. Do I get another one?
Yeah.
Okay. How politically motivated is all this, in your opinion?
Well, there's a lot of parts of it, right? I mean, and it's funny because we've heard political motivation on the part of the Russians and the Saudis to try to flatten the price of oil to adversely impact the U.S. economy because they'd be much happier negotiating with a president that's not named Trump. We've heard, you know, conspiratorial theories about the timing of notification to the administration on the presence of the first diagnosed case of the COVID-19. I don't think you can ever remove politics, unfortunately, in this day and age from a portion of the equation. But I will say, and I even texted Tommy over the weekend, when I heard Steve Mnuchin gushing about Nancy Pelosi on Saturday, it almost knocked me out of my chair. So I'm hopeful that that will take a back seat, although it's hard to think it won't still be in the car.
Yeah. Okay. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
And real quick, a reminder to ask a question, *9. We'll give it a second to see if any other questions queue up. Really appreciate everyone joining us on the call this evening.
Especially on St. Patrick's Day. The turnout was fantastic, so we really, really appreciate it. And we will ask for feedback if we know you were on the call and could make this a part of our regular communication if it's effective.
At this time, it looks like there's one other question. We're going to go to phone number 816-591-6574. Go ahead when you're ready.
I have a question. It, you know, with all this money that we're going to, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but is there a long-term consequence to all the money that we're borrowing and giving out? I mean, is that bode poorly for the long-term economy?
Yeah, that is a great question. It's a great question. In fact, it even had come up. Someone specifically asked the Treasury Secretary that today when he was leaving the Senate and took a few press questions. And he said, look, I mean, it has to be a secondary consideration at this point because we're in emergency mode. And he said, one of the great things is if the Treasury borrows this money from the Fed, given how low interest rates are, it does make it easier to pay back. But we are in an economy that has a very large budget deficit, and this would be added on to that deficit. So the expectation, of course, would be that whether this money was segregated for purposes of payback or if it gets thrown into the general pot, I do think it's something that deserves compartmentalization. You know, we were talking earlier about going through the global financial crisis. People used to talk about the alphabet soup of solutions. You had TARP, you had TALF, you had all kinds of different things that the government created to provide liquidity and stability to the teetering financial system. With the specific designated efforts, the government actually made money, right? They made loans to distressed industries at low rates of interest, and they were more than made whole, and in some cases had warrants and contingencies that they even made more money than they lent. That didn't get a lot of publicity, but it is a fact. Hopefully, again, the fiscal responsibility, going back to the prior caller's question, is a political issue. And if we can get to where there becomes harmony, and who knows, right? I guess stranger things have happened than from a crisis is born more collaboration. Maybe that could be something that we push forward as a country in addressing in the future so that when the inevitable crisis comes, we don't have to think about answers to just your to exactly your question. But it's a great question.
Yeah, and I think a follow-up point would be if in the absence of a significant fiscal response, you know, what's the depth of the economic contraction, right? So if according to John Nagel, the economic estimates are for a 5% GDP reduction, if it was 7 to 8% without any fiscal stimulus, what is the lost revenue from taxes in that scenario? So while it's going to be expensive for these programs, in the absence of them, it might be more expensive.
That makes sense.
Thank you for your question. We have another question from phone number 931-248-0845. Go ahead when you're ready. I'm sorry, go ahead when you're ready, 931-248-0845.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yes, so my question is, there was a term that was used repeatedly in your presentation, and I would just ask in a simple way, from a financial standpoint, what is the term exogenous and how you mention exogenous effects and so on? That was a little unclear to me, so that's the first part of my question. The second part of my question is, while the Carno-19 virus has been certainly a sort of belly punch to the economy, creating a huge contraction, weren't there also some rather significant recessionary pressures, bear pressures in place in the economy prior to the Carno horizon? And that sort of says to me, you mentioned earlier about a recovery rate, and I know we can't put a time on it, but wouldn't that sort of dictate more of a U-shaped recovery rather than something more jagged like a W? Is that possible? Isn't that likely? That's the end of my question.
Yeah, that's a great, both great questions. So exogenous just is something that is evolves from an external factor. Something, you know, we compare exogenous to something that's man-made, right? The global financial crisis was a man-made problem. But something that in just by the very nature of sort of the genesis from the health and like health generated crisis, that's exogenous. I think your point is interesting about some of the issues the economy may have been happily burying because the market had done really well, and what laid beneath, right, may have been what exacerbated the steepness of the decline, right? We were, until the 9th of March, which was the 11-year anniversary of the market bottoming in 2009, we were in a what is still considered a bull market. So we were in an uninterrupted bull market for 11 years. We were in an uninterrupted economic expansion for 11 years. Those are both unparalleled in their length over the course of market history. So there were lots of calls for concern just because of how long it had been, but the pushback to that was how strong it had been, which was not very. Right? We never really saw, and there was a very famous economist, you see on TV all the time, named Mohamed Alarian, who coined a phrase, escape velocity. Right, when we went to the depths of financial crisis, we never saw like a 4.5% GDP, 5% GDP like we did in the early 80s. So we just had this slow and steady progression of economic growth that was always unremarkable, which lent credence to the fact that the stock market didn't necessarily have to undergo the same amount of volatility it tended to a typical business cycle. But some of the things that were mentioned by the prior caller, the level of debt that was in the economy was a concern. The valuations on the stock market, which by no means extreme, but at an upper end of normal, were a concern. And I think a lot of that, right, may have caught the market in a state of complacency that could have exacerbated that decline, because I think there may have been, oh my gosh, I knew this was coming, now's the time I really need to bail out mentality, that just kind of snowballed. So I think it's two great questions. I think that you hit upon a good point that could have exacerbated some of the volatility.
Okay, we're going to take our last question from 913-579-1528. Go ahead when you're ready.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Do you have any opinion on the impact on real estate or home prices in the next few months to a year?
Yeah, so good question. Obviously, there's no part of the economy that this disruption will not touch. It is whether that's domestically or globally. You know, the good thing about real estate, as we know, is we don't see the price of real estate on our screen in real time every day. So in terms of the behavioral impact from an investment perspective, that's why real estate can be advantageous just given its illiquidity. But as it relates to whether it's commercial or residential, when you think about businesses that are contracting and or individuals that are losing their job or have reduced or lost income, their ability to pay rent is lessened. Their ability to buy a new home is impacted. Same on the business side. If a business has to close its doors or a restaurant goes out of business, there is vacancies there that tends to have a ripple effect felt within the rest of the real estate sector. So I don't think it's unrealistic to see some impact on the real estate side. The good thing is if we get kind of a sharp recovery, it might insulate real estate just because of the speed of which all this will happen, where it won't necessarily impact properties in the near term. But on the positive side, we have low mortgage rates, right? Because of interest, the reduction in interest rates. So that could provide some pent up demand on the residential side, and frankly, on the commercial side, as investors are looking for yield. But I think a mild correction in certain parts of the country as it relates to real estate is not out of the question.
Thanks.
Well, we want to thank everyone again for dialing in and giving up part of your St. Patrick's Day evening. It is every day has seemed to be quite adventurous in the markets, and we don't suspect that to calm down anytime super soon. But, you know, we do have a lot of confidence in the resiliency of our economy. We actually have a lot of confidence in the ingenuity of our biotechnology and healthcare industries. And there was a gentleman being interviewed tonight on CNBC from a biotechnology company and talking about the prospects and development initiatives underway for a vaccine. And if not a vaccine, there are a number of companies that are competing for different treatments for this coronavirus. It always seems very difficult in the midst of unresolved crisis. I thought it was helpful for John to talk about resolved crisis. And like that, at some point, we'll reference the coronavirus crisis that started as a healthcare crisis, became an economic crisis, and we're working our way through it. We're very hopeful that we will see aisles continue to be crossed, as well as I's continue to be dotted, is legislation comes to assist at a time when it would be great to have a very positive affection for our government in assisting in a difficult period. So we'll leave you with that. And thank you again for your time. And thank you so much for being clients of Kavar Capital. And please, again, to reiterate, there's never a time that you can't get a hold of Tom, myself, Steph, John, or John. We're here for whatever is on your mind, whenever it's on your mind. So thank you again for all that you do for us.
Thank you.